DW, Living Planet, with Jordan Wilden.
As Christmas has passed and we look towards 2019, what a year it's been. Our environment has been at the forefront of political discussions, policy change and public conversation, for better or for worse. This week on Living Planet, we're doing something a little bit different. We're looking at how climate change may affect the holiday season for years to come. Allow us one final Christmas story before the season's over. How exactly will Christmas change as the Earth gets increasingly warmer? The ice-cold, snowy regions of the North Pole, where Santa is said to reside, is not free from the effects of climate change. Inuits who live in the northernmost parts of the world are facing lifestyle changes due to climate change. Elise Skuer has more.
Ayu Peter is sewing a traditional Inuit coat for her granddaughter. She carefully stitches together an oversized hood with her fingers hardened and cracked from the work. In the 35 years she's lived in Canada's Arctic, she says she's witnessed the sea ice changing.
Hunters that used to hunt from 1981 and to this day, seasoned hunters are falling through the ice, and they shouldn't. The water is becoming more accessible much sooner, and then it forms later.
Aluminum boats dot Iqaluit's beach, a community so known for its Arctic char, the name translates into many fish. Earlier this month, an icebreaker cleared the way through Frobisher Bay, and lifelong hunters like Solomon Awa are now anxious to get on the water. For them, hunting culture is important, passed down from generation to generation.
People start teaching their child to go to school at age 5. And I started going out hunting, not really hunting, but helping out and going out with my dad at age 5.
Long a nomadic culture, Inuit have survived on walrus, narwhal, seals, and fish. Nunavut is Canada's most northern territory, and very little grows on the rugged tundra. Each of its 25 communities are accessible only by airplane for most of the year. Longer open water seasons could mean a big boost to the economy with an increase to marine traffic. But it could also mean an upset to the delicate ecosystem Inuit rely on. In Clyde River, Isakilak hunts to put food on the table.
Anything that has lungs, pretty much, even char, you name it, I've probably hunted it here in the Arctic.
What he doesn't eat, he shares with elders and anyone who needs it. That's important because food insecurity in Canada's Arctic is at a crisis level. Basic necessities cost up to 3 times more than what they cost in the south. During the winter, when all the food is flown in, a head of cauliflower or a carton of juice can cost more than 10 Canadian dollars or about 7 euros. A bag of grapes could be double that. But catching caribou or seal means a full freezer and a pelt that could be used for clothing.
It's our country food. It's something we grew up on. Something that you can't replace with a store-bought food.
Researchers at the National Snow and Ice Data Center track changes to sea ice using satellite images. The data shows a steep rate of decline, which has accelerated over the past decade. And the changes cannot be explained by weather patterns. The evidence points to a climatic shift. Trevor Taylor is a policy director with Oceans North. He says the high seas area, far away from communities, has seen some of the most dramatic change.
Human memory, human history, this ice cover predates it. And in our lifetime, it'll go from that to a possibility of very little and perhaps even no sea ice cover in the height of summer.
With no regulation to stop it, Taylor says someone, probably within his lifetime, will sail a fishing vessel into that delicate area.
And they will probably catch fish. There's a strong probability that they would overfish. And it's really hard to say then what would happen after that.
But scientists say there are animals who are already feeling the effect of sea ice decline. Polar bears seem to be getting thinner as their hunting platforms shrink. Seals need snow and ice to give birth, and some researchers say pups have drowned when the ice breaks up before they're weaned.
But right now it's a very healthy population.
IU Peter argues that environmentalists are exaggerating the issue. The artist is also an activist and has been fighting against the European Union's ban on seal products for years. She says the seal population has been booming since that ban was put in place, and saying otherwise only hurts Inuit hunters.
They have the highest rate of food insecurity. They have the highest rate of unemployment. We have the highest cost of living. So when you add all those things together and then you're not able to make money out of the seal to buy gas and ammunition, it has been devastating. I don't think the Europeans recognize how devastating it has been for our communities.
Peter hopes to use the changes to sea ice to her advantage. More and more cruise ships are visiting the Arctic, and for the past several years, she's worked as an Inuit cultural guide.
Tourism has grown with foreign ships from Europe coming directly to Nunavut and then sailing. I think it's a humongous opportunity that we are not developing.
But with economic opportunity comes potential environmental peril. Ship traffic has doubled over the last decade, but Canada has mapped only a small portion of Arctic waters.
You know, these areas are extremely remote. Even when you're in a community or close to a community, there's limited capacity to be able to help you if you get in trouble. Search and rescue is practically non-existent. The infrastructure is needed, but even then, you know, you can put a whole lot of infrastructure for search and rescue and oil spill containment and whatnot, and you can very easily find yourself somewhere where you are a long way away from that capacity.
Looking out at Iqaluit's waters provides an instant reminder of the potential danger. Emblazoned with the words, "no smoking," a tanker ship floats in wait to deliver this year's fuel.
If one of them spills all that oil, it's going to be devastating for the community that is closest and for the animals. They're going to be so hungry.
I don't know if there's a right one here.
Today, Awa's biggest concern is fixing his boat. He says he won't believe any doomsday scenarios, and regardless of the changes to the ice cover, he believes Inuit will adapt.
I don't really believe that it's going to be difficult for a traditional way of hunting. We just follow with the flow. If it doesn't freeze up till January, we still go out boating. We still go hunting in a traditional way.
For Deutsche Welle, I'm Elise Skura in Iqaluit, Nunavut.
I can go boating.
Christmas tradition goes that the good children get given oranges and lumps of coal go to those who have been bad. But as we move away from fossil fuels, does that mean there's more coal to give away at Christmas? Or will it simply stay in the ground? In Poland, a town known for its history with coal hosted this year's climate conference, COP24. The town, Katowice, has been making a move towards a greener future. This report comes from Richard Fuchs and is presented by Ruby Russell.
In Poland, the name Katowice is synonymous with mining, coal and steel. The city, which has a population of around 300,000, is home to Europe's largest coal company, Polska Grupa Górnicza. Andrzej Unsiger from the think tank Climate Analytics puts it like this.
In Poland, coal isn't just something you burn. Coal has a central place in Polish identity.
But there's more to Katowice than coal. The city is changing rapidly. It's becoming greener and more sustainable. And this is a transformation with many faces. Marcin Górniok and his colleagues at the Katowice Central Mining Institute are among those driving this change. They have taken on one of the most serious problems caused by the coal industry. Between November and April, the city is frequently blanketed in thick, acrid smog. It's a homemade problem, literally. Over 80% of private households get their heat from old-fashioned coal stoves. Soot and particulate matter are released, unfiltered, directly into the air. And that's a huge public health problem. According to the environmental group Katowice Smog Alarm, it's equivalent to the average resident smoking 1,711 cigarettes per year, an involuntary habit of nearly 5 a day. Marcin Gordniuk, an environmental engineer, and his colleagues have developed drones capable of sniffing out the problem. Equipped with sensors and cameras, they sweep over the city's roofs and chimneys, an airborne patrol in search of heating violations. The air flows through a shoebox-sized black unit attached to the bottom of the drone that measures the levels of 6 different pollutants. The researchers are using it to build up a map of Katowice's air quality.
The aim is to indicate the pollution areas and prepare maps when we can visualize those data, just to show to the society how the air quality is changing, how the air quality is, how it looks right now, and to build us the awareness of inhabitants about the types of fuel that should be burned in their households and how to prevent smog phenomena, how should they act to take care about their own health. Yeah.
If change is in the air, it's happening on the ground too. Environmental activists like Witold are using plants to transform the city. He's a street artist and roams Katowice planting trees, shrubs and flowers wherever he feels they're needed. In particular, he's brightening up sidewalks and scraps of wasteland. He laughingly calls himself a garden partisan. In the middle of Hordjuv Market on the outskirts of Katowice, he picks up a shovel, digs a hole and plants a small spruce.
It's called sometimes illegal. I have no document to say that this ground is mine or I user, owner or whatever. So in this matter it's illegal. But if I do it and I year after year I see how plants grow up, I think it's good. Not everything what is illegal is bad.
Witold, a lanky 40-something, with a goatee and beret, isn't waiting for the Polish government or global climate agreements. Instead, he gets his shovel into the ground as often as he can. He knows at least 15 others in the city who have joined him in the green underground. Mostly, they're all doing it for the same reason, he says.
I did it for myself, because I every day cross this area 3 or 4 times a day. I don't like it, the look. So I do it for myself. And some people said it was good. One guy from the other building did the same. And I think, I have a real impact to area where he lives.
Katowice's mayor, Marcin Krupa, is grateful for the city's change of face, even if officially he can't express any sympathy with the guerrilla gardeners. Krupa is convinced that the coal capital can evolve into a centre for congresses and cultural events. His model is Germany's Ruhr area, which has been transformed from an industrial heartland to a centre of culture with an abundance of green spaces. Marek Roszycki of the environmental consultancy Atmoterm has more modest ambitions. He says Katowice sets an important example for one reason.
Carbon economy in this region is the reality and will be in a couple of next years. So maybe it's a good place to discuss what to do with the regions which are coal-based.
That report was presented by Ruby Russell and filed by Richard Fuchs. One of the things that makes Christmas Christmas are Santa's reindeer. Now, research suggests that climate change might be changing the migratory habits of wild reindeer, or caribou as they're known. What's more, Dancer and Prancer and the rest of the reindeer, which would have been pulling Santa's sleigh, would have all been female, as Sam Baker learned when speaking to researchers at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
We often talk about is the fact that all those reindeer are probably females, not males. Because if they still have their antlers at this time of year, that usually means they're pregnant and that they're not males then. All those names are wrong.
This is Lincoln Parrott. He's the research coordinator at Alaska's Department of Fish and Game, and he spends some of his time looking at how climate change is affecting caribou migration patterns.
Yeah, so in terms of climate change long-term, you know, one of the things with caribou is that they're just notoriously variable in general. So for the last decade or so, if you compare the last decade, maybe even 20 years, there's a place where we collar caribou, and it's a fixed point. We do it from a river, and we capture these caribou as they're crossing the river in boats. They're not in boats, we're in boats. And they cross the river, and when they get into the deeper part of the river, we come up on them on boats and capture them. And so we're totally dependent on those caribou. It's not like we're in a helicopter and we're flying around and catching caribou wherever they are. We're waiting for them to cross the river. And the past 2 years, we normally would capture 20 to 30 caribou out of these rivers, and we've only caught 3 or 4 because the migrations are so late that they're not even crossing before the river freezes. And one of the things that that's led to is, of course, you know, people are trying to hunt them at the same time. They are hoping to hunt bulls, and once the bulls get into rut, then they don't want to hunt them anymore because caribou really change physiologically and are basically inedible during the rut. So it's had some pretty profound changes, and people are really, really noticing. And one of the things that I thought for sure was true was that migrations were getting later and later. And turned out, when we actually looked at it, it seemed like there was a hint of that, but there's so much variability in those caribou migrations that it wasn't significant, you know, it wasn't statistically significant at all. In fact, some of the earlier migrations that we'd seen were actually also within the last 10 years. And so getting back to that original point, caribou are just astoundingly variable. There's a funny quote that people often use when they're giving presentations. They'll say something to the effect of, "Ladies and gentlemen, this year is the 46th consecutive year of unusual caribou migration." Now, there's another thing, right? With climate change, theoretically, things are getting warmer, but one of the things that we've found, again, is that the past 2-3 years have been very late springs, and so they've migrated later. So It's just an astounding amount of variability that kind of, I think things are getting earlier and that climate is affecting, you know, migration specifically. But again, it's so variable that the data don't really prove it out in any statistical sense.
Gotcha. So they're a pretty challenging species to study for those reasons then?
For sure. You know, another example, you know, people talk about caribou cycling, but you know, in the modern era of science, basically, since we've had radio collars and things like that and all the kind of tools that we use right now, for most of the herds in North America, we have yet to even see one cycle. So,
really?
You know,
I've seen that populations seem to be declining across the world, but have you seen that in Alaska? Or kind of what conversation have you had with colleagues and other parts of the world?
We definitely are seeing that, for example, in Canada. You know, their populations are at all-time lows, again, in the modern era, right? Who knows what things were like 100 years ago. But for the modern era, they're definitely experiencing all-time lows. I think they really struggle to tie it to anything.
So there may be some climate effects going on, but the degree to which we can kind of understand those is challenging.
Yeah, it's right confounded now in these wild populations, you know, that have, especially in Alaska, right, where you have basically, it's an intact ecosystem, you know. We have all the predators we used to have, you know. There's not very many people, so hunting has a minimal effect. It's really, you know, all the things that could happen to them still happen to them.
Looking ahead, do you think this is something, like you were saying, you kind of need like 100 years minimum to kind of have a better sense of cycles and know for sure what's going on? Is this something we're not going to know about for sure for a while?
It sure feels like it to me. I mean, again, these caribou are so dynamic and variable. in what they do. I mean, one of the things we think that happens is, you know, we see these abrupt declines or crashes or whatever you want to call it, and we think part of it is that they basically hide the fact that they're struggling to find food by the fact that they move so well. So they basically are moving, and you cannot detect that there's any problem at all. They're kind of making it happen until one day they just ran out of options, and boom, they began to decline, you know. And I feel like we're a little bit in that situation with a lot of these other things with climate. We are not necessarily certain what the effects are going to be. You know, is it going to be, you know, heavy snow winters? Is it going to be real mild winters? You know, that's also like when I mentioned, you know, if you get 2 degrees colder, now it's just sort of a, you know, a mild cold winter. 2 degrees warmer, it's really heavy, wet snow coming off the ocean. 2 degrees warmer than that, it's just rain. And so you take every single piece of that, and it becomes very, very difficult to detect or predict what the change will be. For example, if you get, you know, a longer summer, that's good for them. They don't have to deal with winter as long. They have longer period of time to build fat stores, to build protein stores. So that's really good. But if you then come into a really hard winter, did you lose everything that you gained? Is one of the byproducts of having, you know, a nice longer summer that certain parasites, instead of having one life cycle or two life cycles, have three life cycles now. And that is a drain on those caribou. So there's a negative there. But I think change is scary. You know, every human sort of tends to view change as a little bit scary. And so I think personally as a scientist, I can't help but have that bias, you know, that like, I don't know what's going to happen, but you know, some of it looks pretty scary, but in the end, trying to actually predict what the effects on those caribou are going to be, it just seems profoundly difficult to me.
DW reporter Sam Baker speaking to Lincoln Parrott, the research coordinator at Alaska's Department of Fish and Game. For those of us who celebrate Christmas, a Christmas tree is a crucial part of the season. Here in Bonn, some of the streets were lined with fir trees. But those of us who brought a tree into our home for Christmas, did we make the right decision? Is a real tree or a plastic tree better for the environment? Julian Kessler Diamur looked into this in Canada.
Families bundled in scarves, hats, and gloves huddled together on the wooden tractor pole. The early morning air is crisp and cold, and the wind cuts through the trees. Rows and rows of pine, spruce, and fir trees line the unpaved main road, which is covered in a coat of freshly fallen snow. This is the Horton Tree Farm. With a handsaw in tow, the families are here, about an hour north of Toronto, to choose their Christmas tree ahead of this year's holiday. And if anyone knows which tree to choose, it's Hal Horton. This has been his family's business since 1964.
The big trick is to come early in the season, because as the, you know, the trees get cut, the best ones get cut early in the season, and it gets harder and harder to find them. This one here, wow, that's pretty heavy duty for the baler there, guys.
But choosing a Christmas tree is no easy task, and it brings up a debate that is almost as perennial as the holiday itself. Is it more sustainable to buy a new natural tree every year from a local store or farm, or pick up an artificial one that requires very little maintenance and can be reused again and again? Unsurprisingly, Horton says a natural tree is best, not least because he says his farm makes sure to continually replant the Christmas trees in a sustainable way.
The soil's usually not disturbed near as much as with regular farming. So all the little the flora and fauna get a chance to thrive and live in amongst these trees as they're growing. Not to mention, young, vigorous trees are pumping out a lot of oxygen as they're growing. So it's good for the environment in that sense.
Fresh-cut Christmas trees are big business for local farmers. More than 2,000 farms harvested Christmas trees across Canada in 2011, with most farms located in the East Coast provinces of Quebec, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Ontario. The industry generated nearly 56 million euros last year alone, and 1.7 million Christmas trees were exported from Canada. Nearly all of those trees went to the United States, and others were exported to countries across the Caribbean and as far away as Russia, Thailand, and the United Arab Emirates. Rob Keane is CEO of Forests Ontario, a group that promotes healthy forests and tree planting. He says over a million Christmas trees are harvested in Ontario every year. Keane stresses that many municipalities in Ontario will dispose of natural trees after the holidays in a way which keeps the tree's life cycle fully sustainable.
The real trees, they actually have a fantastic aroma, they look great, and they are 100% biodegradable. So a lot of municipalities at the end of the Christmas season will collect the Christmas trees, mulch those trees, and then spread that mulch throughout their areas, and that mulch then decomposes, adding those nutrients back into the soil. 100% biodegradable.
But some conifers require more pesticides to help them grow, and these chemicals can harm bees and other helpful insects. Horton says his farms moved away from pesticides over the last 20 years, but that fir trees generally require the most pest control. Driving long distances to pick up a natural tree from a farm also adds to their carbon footprint. Some studies suggest that fake trees may actually have an environmental impact less than or equal to natural trees, depending on the number of times they are reused every year. A 2010 study by consulting firm PE International suggests that if a fake tree is used for 4 years or more, its carbon footprint will be less than a household that buys a new natural tree every Christmas in that same period. Another life cycle report conducted in the Montreal area in 2009 found that a family would need to hold on to their fake Christmas tree for 20 years for it to be environmentally sustainable. And the options are endless at Canadian Tire, a big box store that sells artificial trees. Customers can pick a Richmond, Bromley, or Blue Pine, potted or fixed on a stand. Even bright pink or white trees and trees covered in fake snow are available here. Most artificial trees are made from a variety of plastics. That includes polyvinyl chloride, a synthetic plastic polymer known as PVC that is non-biodegradable. Canada also imports artificial trees every year. Nearly all of the more than $65 million worth of artificial trees Canada imported last year came from China, a long journey that adds to each tree's carbon footprint. Andrew Lorson is a professor who specializes in ecosystems at Ryerson University in Toronto. He said most artificial trees are made of composite materials that take a long time to decompose. So if you do opt for a fake conifer, he says you should try to keep it around for at least a decade.
Choose it well and don't get rid of it as soon as one or two of the LEDs go out, or you decide that the blue tree is no longer fashionable. If you do pick an artificial tree, make sure that you're in it for a long term, so that those materials that are invested in your tree can be enjoyed and used for a long time rather than disposed of.
Ultimately, the choice is a matter of convenience for many people. Picking up an artificial tree can be easier for families that live in cities and may not have a way to get to a Christmas tree farm or lug a fresh tree home. Fake trees can be carried out of the store in a box and easily assembled at home. Patty, who did not want to give Living Planet her last name, was shopping for tree ornaments about a week before Christmas at the store in Toronto's West End. She said she first opted for an artificial tree because she discovered she is allergic to pine. She kept her last artificial tree for around 20 years.
I did have a real tree many years ago and realized every time I walked into the room, I was coughing, I couldn't breathe, and realized that, you know, I was allergic to the pine. There's no reason to change it or whatever. You know, I chose a tree I wanted and it's going to be around for a while.
That's the key, according to the experts. Keep your artificial tree as long as possible. And if you opt for a natural one, do your research and choose a tree grown close to home in a sustainable way. Jillian Kessler-Damore, Living Planet, Toronto, Canada.
That's all from us here at Living Planet for this week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you next week, which, as it happens, will be a new year. All the best for 2019. I have been, and still am, Jordan Wildon. Until next time.
A long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than the last. I can't remember the last thing that you said as you were
by so fast. And it's one more.